Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
A name that still sends chills up the American spine. He was angry at a hard copy story and pirated video showing him smoking marijuana in a previous jail.
Reflection of children coming up in the grave.
This pirate prison video of Charles Manson was broadcast for the first time ever on hard copy 2 weeks ago. Puffing a marijuana cigarette, Manson talked about his family and sang his songs.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners, the final, and I promise, final episode on the Manson family and the murders committed in the summer of 1969. We left off last week with the murder of Gary Hinman, a music teacher, allegedly sometimes mescaline grower, distributor, but mostly a man that was fairly straight-laced for the times, that got caught up with the wrong people. Perhaps because of his generosity in letting hippies down on their luck traveling through crash, or just falling into the likes of a crowd associated with, and obviously including, Charles Manson, led to his untimely death. Bobby Beausoleil was the one said to have actually murdered Gary Hinman. And when he was arrested, Charlie was not happy, nervous in fact. He thought Bobby's arrest may point the finger at the rest of the family, mostly himself, and Charlie had plans that didn't include that. Still wanting to be a rock star, but likely confidence dwindling in that category after Terry Melcher said no to him. So his plans may have zeroed more in on being the guru cult leader, ladies' man, family leader, that was actually turning out to be more successful than anything else he'd ever done in life. He was good at the power of suggestion and manipulation. He was good at targeting and finding people, men, women, or girls, that would be susceptible to it. He was good at the art of the con. And if he wasn't going to be a rock star in 1969, he was going to become famous for something else. Helter Skelter. His family of lost souls. His wayward, insane personality that he would ride straight through until the end. And this 1991 hard copy episode might be the best indication of who Charles Manson is. Both nonsensical and convincing at the same time. Both arrogant and humble. He is truly an enigma.
I'm upset with hard copy on this level. From this perspective, other inmates come to me and they say, Charlie, we didn't like what they said. We know different. And all you people who keep putting that shit out on the air, I'm going to give you another reason why I'm here. I'm here to help you a little bit. Because the guy next door to me said, Charlie, I know you and I like you. And you've helped me out of a few tight situations, and I owe you one. I said, what's that? He said, I seen that show on TV the other day, and that's wrong. I get out in 8 months. Is there anything you want me to do? Now, what do you want me to tell him? Do you want me to tell him to come and see you? Do you want me to be the guy you're trying to make me? Do you want me to be the guy that orders people to die? Do you want me to be the dispensation of life and death? You convicted me for dispensating life and death, man. The president of the United States can't even do that.
He was furious with hard copy that they had suggested that his Helter Skelter murder plot had any association with his failed music career.
The people around me wanted me to be what you call rock and roll singer. I wasn't even thinking of anything like that. Doris Day's son comes to me with the offer, and I say, okay, it sounds good.
But You're saying that Terry Melcher misrepresented to you your possibilities as a singer and made false promises to you?
I wasn't in trade to be anything. I was what I am. I'm not trying to labor into someone else's opinion of what they think of me. I care less what other people think of me. I got a letter from a couple of my old ladies that just flew in from other places. And believe me, all of my friends that used to be nice little gentle flower children, they are very mad and mean old witches now, you dig? And they don't like a lot of the things that you people have been doing, see? We got a few helicopters going. We got Blackhawks and we got Apaches. We got Captain Stereo and Uvalla. We got a lot of good things in this family.
Charles Tex Watson has become a minister.
Praise the Lord.
You know about that?
If it works for him, you know, get on. If the wheel rolls, man, like, what can I say?
Would you like to join his congregation?
I'm already in his congregation, I thought. I've never had anything against Tex. Tex has been all right with me. Tex kept his word.
Tex Watson has a wife and three kids by way of conjugal visits and since he's been in prison. And that the policy here is that you don't have any physical contact with anybody, that you talk to him through a glass. How does it happen that Tex Watson has three kids and you don't even have any physical contact with anybody?
I guess Tex is smarter than I am. Tex is a pretty smart boy. He's got a college education. He reads and writes pretty good. All them guys are pretty good. If you're stupid in jail, man, you're locked up all the time. You got to be smart in jail to get out on the line. I'm not too smart.
Do you think that Patricia Krenwinkel, Leslie Van Houten, Susan Atkins ought to be paroled someday?
I think they should not only be paroled, but I think you should do exactly as they tell you to do.
The parole boards say they're...
Parole boards are a bunch of stupid bureaucrats, man, who are laying up on the dollar bill. Take the poison and die in that cell, or say you're full of and we'll let you go. You know, so the parole board wants me to go in and kowtow to their reality and say that their reality is the real reality and my reality is really the stupid, dumb reality.
This is the story of the nights of August 8th through 10th, 1969. The murder that followed that and Death Valley. The place they thought they were safe from all harm or punishment. But the place that they would slip up, get caught, and stand trial for the murders that ended the summer of love. When most people think of the Manson murders, they think of Sharon Tate. And we should think of her, along with all of the others. Sharon Tate would be 80 today. Sharon Tate would have birthed a baby boy in 1969. And Sharon Tate should have lived in whatever capacity the world shook out for her. But she should have at least lived longer than her precious 26 years. And so should have Abigail Folger, Jay Sebring, Warchek Frykowski, Stephen Parent, and Lino and Rosemary Bianca, and Donald Shorty Shea. But the Manson family ripped all of their potential from them and from their families. It's all so senseless, but let's get into it. Trigger warning. This episode is going to be very rough, scary, disturbing, and deals with grotesque crimes and talk of rape, so please take care when listening. Abigail Folger was 26 when she was murdered by the Manson family. She was the daughter of Peter and Inez Folger, an heiress to the Folger coffee fortune. Her great-great-grandfather, J.A. Folger, became the sole owner of Folger's Coffee in 1872, after working as a carpenter there in a previously named company since 1850. I'm actually pretty fascinated with that story, but no time for it now. Perhaps I'll do an episode on it at a later date, but it's pretty fascinating. Her parents divorced when Gibby, as her loved ones called her when she was very young. She was into art, reading, and poetry. She painted and even wrote her own poetry. She was a standout student and attended college at Radcliffe in Cambridge. Well, a freshman in college, she became a debutante on December 21st, 1961, at the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco, where she made her official debut into San Francisco's high society. Her debutante ball was one of the highlights of the social season, with Folger wearing a bright yellow Christian Dior gown that she had purchased in Paris. After graduating, she enrolled in the fall of 1964 at Harvard, also in Cambridge, Mass., where she graduated and worked and received a degree in art history. She worked as a publicity director at an art museum in Berkeley for a short time, before moving to New York, where she worked on Robert Kennedy's ill-fated campaign, and where she met Wojciech Frykowski. They were introduced by a Polish author who was married to a steel heiress, and the two hit it off. Wojciech wanted to pursue his writing career, while Abigail wanted to get involved with a new welfare project that was currently underway. So they decided to move to Los Angeles. They rented a home in L.A.'s famous Laurel Canyon, and they were neighbors with singer Cass Elliot of the Mamas and the Papas, and they became fast friends. Both of Polish descent and old friends, Roman Polanski, Sharon Tate's husband, and Frykowski, introduced Gibby and Sharon, and they also became very close friends. Abigail and her boyfriend also met Jay Sebring through the Polanskis. The five quickly began to hang out together and were known to be a part of the beautiful people crowd in Hollywood. Abigail even invested money into Sebring International, Jay Sebring's hair care products for men.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
On March 15, 1969, Abigail, Sebring, and Frykowski attended the catered housewarming party of the Polanskis at 150 Cielo Drive. Over 100 guests such as Jane Fonda, Peter Fonda, Tony Curtis, Warren Beatty, Michelle Phillips, John Phillips, and Cass Elliot attended. Then on March 23, 1969, an odd incident occurred at Cielo Drive. That afternoon, Abigail and Frykowski went over to the Polanski's home for a going-away dinner party for Tate, who was leaving for Rome the next day. Sebring was there, as well as Shiruka Hatami, a photographer who was there to take publicity shots for Tate. The odd incident involved a strange-looking man who had appeared on the property. As the occupants of the house sat in the dining room, which faced the front of the residence, Hatami felt uneasy about this stranger roaming the Polanski estate. Looking at people he did not know, so he left the house to confront the man. From the front porch, the party inside could be seen through the large dining room windows. Hatami asked the stranger if he could help him. The stranger said he was looking for someone by the name of Terry Melcher. Tommy didn't recognize that name, and he made it clear to the stranger that this was the Polanski residence. Melcher did not live there anymore. Later, this stranger was identified to have been Charles Manson. On April 1st, 1969, while Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski were away in Europe filming movies, Abigail and Frykowski moved into the Cielo Drive home at the request of Roman. On July 20th, 1969, Tate returned to California from London and asked Abigail and Frykowski to remain on Cielo Drive with her until her husband, Roman, arrived. When Sharon arrived in L.A., it was the day of the moon landing, and the trio, along with Jay and Tate's parents and two younger sisters, all watched the moon landing on television together. Then on Friday morning, August 8th, 1969. Sharon held a late lunch at Cielo Drive with Abigail and two other of Sharon's friends. Sharon went down for a nap, 8 months pregnant and hot in the LA sun, and Abigail went to an appointment later that afternoon. That evening, just after 9 p.m., Abigail, Frykowski, Jay Sebring, and Sharon Tate went out to a Mexican restaurant called El Coyote to have a meal together. Returning home, Frykowski and Abigail decided to take MDMA together, but then Abigail retired to a different room to read. Their relationship had been on the rocks for a while. He fell asleep on the couch, while Sharon and Jay stayed up in their room talking. I've had a book for years about Sharon Tate. It's more of a coffee table book with gorgeous photos of her, but it also contains memories and letters and excerpts from people who loved her. And I've always loved looking at that and reading the book. She truly seemed like a beautiful soul. The story of Sharon Tate is one that is relatable to many women across many professions and life circumstances. But Sharon Tate's story is different. Well, that's an understatement, murder aside, but her story is different in the fact that she was in Hollywood. She was rubbing elbows with everyone, but she was also a wholesome girl who did dabble in drugs, but she was a bit of a little girl lost, almost only feeling validated by her beauty and trying to make it as a star while truly longing to have a husband and a baby. She did live big, though, and she wanted a big, successful, interesting life. Hollywood will do that to you, and there's no shame in that. Hell, I lived there for 12, 13 years up until I recently moved to Colorado, and I lived big as well. The Sunset Strip, the hills, the backdrop of the movies and chance of success lures you in, and Sharon was no different. I can't say I ever experimented with hard drugs or acid, but I don't blame Sharon who did. It was the 60s, and everyone was experimenting. And Sharon herself, who was a self-confessed sort of square, found that LSD loosened her up a bit. So hell, go for it. But let's start from the beginning of Sharon's life, before going into her adulthood and relationships with men. Sharon was impossibly pretty, sweet, soft-spoken, but also impressionable. She was the daughter of a high-ranking military officer and Southern Belle mother, and she had two sisters, Deborah and Patty. She was adored. As a teenager, Sharon began modeling and competing in beauty pageants. In 1960, her father was stationed in Verona, Italy, and Sharon went to high school there and became the school's very first homecoming queen. She was on student council, and she gained the ability to speak Italian fluently. Unfortunately, the heart-wrenching part for Sharon in her time in Italy is she fell victim to date rape there. But she never told her parents because she didn't want to bring shame on the family. And so she carried that burden for the rest of her short life. And it colored many of her interactions with men. But there were some high points in Italy. She had her first touch of Hollywood coming across a movie set, Adventures of a Young Man, filming in a town nearby Verona. She then got work as an extra in the movie Barabbas, as well as a Pat Boone special. In 1962, her dad was relocated to California, and Sharon and the rest of the family joined, which put her closer to Hollywood. So she headed down to Southern California and met with studio agents and eventually was introduced to Jay Sebring. Sharon had roles in several movies and TV shows, but her most famous was Valley of the Dolls. Well, not a huge hit, but also a huge moneymaker at the time. Sharon did look gorgeous in it, and I personally think she was actually a great actress in it. She also showed comedic chops in The Wrecking Crew, and was all around a budding star. And she was working hard at it. The studio she signed with had her in classes and workouts 8 hours a day, taking dancing, singing classes, as well as speech classes. She was all in, and she was set for success. In an interview with Sharon from 1966, at just 22 years old, she speaks with such maturity and intelligence about her experience rising to stardom that I want you to listen to it.
Sharon Tate, everybody's been saying that the star system has disappeared, that they don't manufacture stars anymore, but you're proof of the contrary. You've been kept under wraps for about 2 years now to be groomed for stardom. Mm-hmm. What is the process like?
Well, it's a very strenuous one, I must say. To begin with, for approximately 3 years, I've had no personal life, I guess you could call it. I've done nothing but study from 8 o'clock in the morning till about 6:30 at night. And then on three evenings out of every week, I went to a night class too.
What were you studying?
Well, I had acting classes, voice, singing, bodybuilding, everything. Absolutely everything. Which is necessary, you know.
They didn't put you in front of a camera at all.
Well, they did actually. My producer had a show called The Beverly Hillbillies, and they would slap a black wig on my head, and I would run out in front of the camera, you know, just to get used to it. Because being in front of the camera and going to classes are two different worlds entirely.
And why did they put the black wig on you? So that people wouldn't recognize you?
Wouldn't recognize me, right.
Well, how did you like this feeling of not being Sharon Tate? A person, but Sharon Tate, a starlet about to be starlet.
No, I don't like that word starlet at all, because there's no such thing, actually. I feel, at least at my estimation, that every person, if they want to be an actress, if they want to stay in the acting world, which is a pretty tough world, before you even make an appearance, it's very necessary to learn your craft first and take as much time and do as much as you can. And so I wasn't upset at all. I was making myself prepared.
You did never feel like a prisoner, that you never, wanted to
not
get
really,
out.
Not really, because I felt that if you're serious about it, it's a lot of hard work. If not, you play and you get absolutely nowhere at all.
Have you any idea what it is they saw in you, besides your obvious mm-hmm. beauty, of course?
Mm-hmm.
What?
This is a mistake I think most young girls make when they want to go into an acting career. When a producer or somebody sees them, they have a fresh, natural quality that no one has touched. It's something that's them. And so when a person starts their acting classes or whatever, they get an idea of what I think a starlet is. And the hair goes up and whirls, the dresses, the clothes change, and unfortunately their whole personality changes. So my idea is the full-time job is to learn your craft and also to try to keep yourself what you really are.
She wanted to prove herself, and she was also on the scene socializing and networking at night. She met Jay Sebring, a Hollywood celebrity hairstylist and sometime drug dealer or just drug supplier, who knows. But his expensive and lavish men's hair salon off La Cienega Boulevard in West Hollywood would treat the stars like Kurt Douglas to not only a haircut and style, but maybe some booze and a bag of Coke during the visit. Sharon and Jay were inseparable, it seems, almost from the moment they met up until their untimely deaths. Her family loved him, and he gave her the royal treatment. Sharon met Hollywood hairstylist Jay Sebring at a party thrown by the owner of the Whiskey A Go-Go. The two did everything together, whether it was eating at the best restaurants, attending various Hollywood parties, or experimenting with psychedelic drugs like LSD. And Sharon's parents were quite impressed with Sebring. They agreed that he treated Sharon like a queen. But while filming The Vampire Killers, or rather, even while auditioning by way of a few dinner dates orchestrated by the head of her studio, Sharon Tate met Roman Polanski. Roman thought she was beautiful, but didn't think much else of her until the third dinner, where they allegedly took acid together and made love. But a romance did eventually blossom after this. And on the set of The Fearless Vampire Killers, in which Roman was the director, they truly fell in love. She had been apart from Jay for months for both of their work engagements, and in that time continued to carry on a romance with Roman. She broke the news to Jay Sebring over the phone, and he immediately rushed off to London determined to win her back. But it was a lost cause. Sharon insisted her love for Roman was genuine. Still, Jay demanded to meet Roman, just to make sure he was worthy of her. The three had dinner, and by the end of the night, Jay reluctantly gave his approval. And then, Roman and Jay became friends of sorts. They were cool with each other. Roman himself was a philanderer, and he was good at convincing Sharon that no man really settles down. Sharon even regurgitates, it seems, his words in an interview later, saying that essentially any man worth it isn't the type of man that's going to be faithful to one woman. Roman and Sharon eventually married in London on Saturday, January 20th, 1968. The star-studded wedding was followed by a reception at the Playboy Club, and then they attended a Supremes concert after their reception and headed off for an extended honeymoon, which included a stop in the Alps. Sharon and Roman were also interviewed by Hugh Hefner around the time of moving into the Cielo Drive house. It's Hugh's weird talk show in the mansion that almost seems like a podcast, but it's filmed. Hugh Hefner is awkward, and so is Roman, frankly. But Sharon seems on point like a star. But the part that's so eerie to me is at about the 5-minute mark, where they talk about violence and about taking care of someone. They're talking about murder. It's tragic to know that Sharon would face even worse than this in just 6 short months.
How do you feel about doing nude scenes in a film?
Well, I feel that if it's a real scene and it's an honest scene, and if it's something where you're stripped naked that you would be doing naturally, you know, making love, which is natural, taking a bath, you know, that's lovely, you know.
In other words, if it has an authentic,
legitimate reason for it, it's beautiful. But if it's contrived, you know, then it becomes vulgar.
How do you feel about violence in films?
Well, I don't feel that violence can make any harm to anybody either. And I think that this sudden awakening of some of producer circles in Hollywood, etc., and sudden violence against violence is just a bad feeling that they have about the things which are happening in this society. And they are looking for some little phony excuse. I do not believe that any violence on television or cinema screen can inspire violence. I don't think that I don't believe in the idea monkey see, monkey do, you know.
Many sociologists, as a matter of fact, seem to feel today that scenes in films or TV can actually act as a catharsis, relieve
positive,
the tensions.
I'm positive. I tell you, what I think is really dangerous and what kind of violence can inspire violence, it's the sterilized, the Hollywood type of violence. I mean, in typical Hollywood Western, they excite you during an hour and a half. They tease you against this bad man who beats everybody, and he's so nasty, and you can't stand him anymore. And in the last moment, the good man with white heart comes and draws and bumps him off without any blood. It's a very clean job. And somehow, subconsciously, from the kid, it develops in your brain idea that when somebody bothers you, you can take judgment upon him, and very easy you can get rid of him without any blood, without convulsions, without the vomiting, without... I saw war, I saw violence, I saw all the things. It didn't make me more violent. I can't stand blood. I can't stand blood in film because I know it's pain, etc. Mm-hmm. And this is an amusement for me to do violent scenes. But I do not believe that it can inspire violence. Besides, you know, suddenly they say that this is so popular, you know, that film is such a medium that reaches everybody. But violence without our society has an old history. In any Catholic school, you see a man nailed to a cross with blood dripping from his side and from his head. You see the whole, the most popular book, especially in this country, is the Bible, when every second page you have unbelievable descriptions of violence, you know, and so I do not believe that suddenly cinema can make a little bit more.
And nudity as well.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
After bouncing around in different cities, even countries, London, Paris, the Chateau Marmont in West Hollywood, early in 1969, less than 6 months before her tragic murder, it came about that Terry Melcher and Candace Bergen had moved out of that Cielo Drive house, and it was apparently Sharon's dream home. So when it came on the market for rent, Sharon jumped on it. But she was often left alone while Roman Polanski cruised the Sunset Strip for women, parties, and drugs. And Frykowski and Abigail Folger were asked by Roman Polanski to look after the house while Sharon was in Italy, and then eventually, after finding out she was pregnant, to look after Sharon until he returned home from his European film shoot. But while Sharon and Roman were away, many strange characters came by the house, as Frykowski was a drug dealer himself, aspiring at the time to become the first Molly dealer in town. So it wasn't that strange when people entered the house that fateful night of August 8th, 1969. Just before the murders, on August 8th through 10th, Charles Manson left and went north for a bit and picked up a new follower named Stephanie at a gas station. According to Charlie's version, she was there with her boyfriend, and Charlie was basically like, "You want to get away from this nerd and come with me?" And it fucking worked somehow. They took acid together, had sex in the desert, and she came back to the ranch. Meanwhile, Bobby Beausoleil had been arrested on August 6th for driving Gary Hinman's car he had stolen after murdering him. Beausoleil had fallen asleep in the car, pulled off on Highway 101 in California. And Manson was not happy about this. Having Bobby in jail meant that the murders could come in connection with the Manson family and Charlie. But the family had a plan. They could commit more murders to look like Gary's murder. That way, while Bobby was in jail, they wouldn't think it was Bobby who killed Gary Hinman. Manson said, "You need to do it in a rich white neighborhood," going along with the framing of the Black Panthers as the murderers and trying to ignite the helter-skelter race war. Charlie also had a vendetta, it seems, against Terry Melcher. Though if he had visited the house previously, like was reported by Sharon Tate and others, he would have known that Terry didn't live there anymore. So regardless of if the motive was to get revenge on Terry Melcher or just to say F you to society and everyone that has more than he has, he chose Cielo Drive as their first murder house. He told the girls to go get their knives, go with Tex, and do whatever Tex told them. Charles Manson maintained that he never told anyone to do anything, and that might partly be true. In Bobby's case with the murder of Gary Hinman, Charlie said to him, "You know what to do," saying it without actually saying it. He was effective in making his followers think everything was their idea, yet he was the puppet master leading it. But this still holds slightly true because according to several family members and Manson himself, the family had come up with the idea to commit more murders to cover up the first one before Charlie got back from his romp up north with Stephanie. But Charlie was the one to put this plan in motion and rally them up, along with getting Tex to do the dirty work of leading the charge. So around 11:30 p.m., Charlie told the girls, Susan Sadie Atkins, Big Patty, and Linda Kasabian, who had only joined the family about a month prior, to get their knives, go with Tex, and do whatever Tex Watson told them to do. And also, to make sure to write something witchy in blood on the walls, making it look connected to Gary Hinman's murder, where they had written political piggy. With Bobby in jail, Helter Skelter began now. Tex's testimony later states that Charlie said to him, "I want you to go to that house where Terry Melcher used to live and totally destroy everyone in that house, as gruesome as you can. Make it a real nice murder, just as bad as you've ever seen, and get all their money." Oddly enough, the group never really left with that much money. And that day, Tex had already taken acid and snorted speed with Susan, so he was flying high by midnight when they arrived at Cielo Drive with knives, wire cutters Manson had given him to cut the phone lines and security gate, and a gun Manson had also given him. Tex then climbed the telephone pole and cut the wire at Cielo Drive. They all then climbed over the gate and hid in the bushes when they saw headlights coming down the driveway. It was Stephen Parent. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, the others were busy stealing parts from cars and cars themselves to outfit dune buggies for their eventual move to Death Valley. Tex told the girls to stay in the bushes and hide while he stepped out of the bushes holding a knife and a gun, ready to attack the driver of the car. Stephen Parent begged for his life, pleading, "Please don't hurt me. I won't say anything. I'm your friend." Stephen Parent was just 18 years old, and he had just dropped by to see the home's caretaker and see if he wanted to buy a radio from him. The caretaker declined but offered Stephen a beer, and they hung out for a short while until Stephen left. They had met a few weeks prior because Stephen had given him a ride up the canyon, and the caretaker said, "Drop by whenever if you want to hang." When Stephen didn't arrive home that night or the next day, his parents were worried sick. He had never done anything like this before, not coming home. He was a good kid. They didn't know what could have happened to him, but they assumed he would be home eventually. But his mother, Juanita, was hysterical when the next day by dinner, Stephen still wasn't there and she was trying to make dinner but couldn't make it through it. So then Stephen's father suggested that they and their three other kids go out to dinner, and maybe when they got back, Stephen would be there. But sadly, he wasn't. And what was left was a business card for the county coroner. His dad was confused. He called, they picked up, and said, "We believe that your son was involved in a shooting." Both he and his wife broke down. They spent that night with their three other children in bed with them, crying, until then they eventually all fell asleep. And the way they found out that the victim was Stephen Parent, after just being named John Doe, was because a reporter had run the license plate number on Stephen's car at the crime scene. They figured out it was registered to Juanita and her husband Wilford Parent, and they went to their house. But when they were out to dinner, the reporter then spoke to a few neighbors who said that, yes, the parents had an 18-year-old son. They also said that the family was very close with their priest at the local Catholic church, and so the reporter called the priest, who said Stephen is a good boy. He's very into radios. He can fix anything. And I think you might be mistaken that he was involved in a shooting. I can't see any reason why Stephen would be at a celebrity's house or even near that area. But he agreed to go to the coroner's, and he identified Stephen. He said he had high hopes for his future. It's just such a senseless tragedy. Tex then asked Linda Kasabian to find an open window in the back. There were two open, but she lied and said that there wasn't because she was so scared. But there was an open window in the front that Tex found, and he used his knife to cut open the screen after telling Linda to sit in the car and be on the lookout. And then he brought Patricia and Susan Atkins in with him. At this point, he told them that they were there to kill everyone in the house. The first person they came across was Wojciech Frykowski. Tex kicked him in the head after Frykowski said, "Who are you? What do you want?" Then Tex said, "I'm the devil, and I'm here to do the devil's business." Tex then told Susan to find others in the house. She entered Abigail's room and eerily waved at her before leaving and going into the room where Sharon and Jay were, but they didn't see her. In an account recorded by Susan Atkins on December 14, 1969, after her arrest, she said, "We had no idea how many people were in the house. When we got into the living room, there was a man, Frykowski, sleeping on the couch. And Tex told me to go down the hall and check the other room, so I went down the hall and found a bedroom. I went in and this girl, Abigail Folger, put down the book she was reading and looked at me. I smiled and waved. I knew they turned on just looking at the house. They hide it from society, but just looking at them, I knew they used narcotics. I guess she thought I was a friend. So then I looked in the other bedroom and saw Sharon Tate and the younger man, the shorter man, Jay Sebring. She was in a see-through shorty nightgown wearing kind of a halter underneath it, but they were just talking and didn't see me. I came back out into the living room and told Tex, there's more in there. And so he told me to go look for the bathroom and get a towel and tie up the man on the couch. I couldn't find it at first, but I finally did. It was a big house. I was shaking so bad I couldn't tie his hands, but I got the towel around, even though I couldn't pull it tight. And he was just so petrified, he just laid down there and didn't say a word. And he kept asking Tex, what do you want? What do you want? Who are you? And that's when Tex said, I'm the devil. I'm here to do the devil's business. We want all your money. Where's your money? He said, my money's in the wallet on the desk. Tex told me to go over and look at the desk, and I said, Tex, it's not there. And then Tex said, go in and get the other people and bring them out here. So I took out my knife, and I went in, and I stood by Abigail Folger's bed and said, go out in the living room. Don't ask any questions. I went into Sharon Tate's room and told her and the man to go out in the living room. I guess the three of them went along so easily because they were pretty much terrified by what was going on. After that, everything just got wild. I'm not sure of the order in which all of it happened. I can only see it in flashes, but it seems that Tex tied the three of them, Sebring, Sharon, and Miss Folger together, wound the rope around them, and then threw it over a beam so I could pull it tight. And then, the way it flashes now, it was all a panic. What's going on? Jay Sebring said, and then proceeded to advance on Tex. I don't know how he got loose, and Tex shot him, and then he fell on the floor. And then Sharon went through a few changes, quite a few changes. I mean, her facial expressions. Oh my God, no, she said. Miss Folger didn't say anything. She just stood there. The man on the couch, I hadn't done a very good job of tying him up with that towel found in the bathroom, and he kept getting loose. But Tex said to him, "Where's your money?" Then we were instructed to Abigail's room, where she said, "The money's in my wallet." Tex instructed her to get it out. She untied her and led her back to the bedroom and told her, "You get it out." She handed them $72 or $73. That's all she had. And then she said, "Do you want my credit cards?" Susan said no. Then she proceeded to lead her back into the living room and tied her back up and put the rope over the beam. One of the ladies cried, "What are you going to do with us?" And Tex said, "You are all going to die." This obviously caused immediate panic. And then Tex ordered Susan to kill the big man on the couch. She went over to him and raised her knife. And she hesitated, she says. And he reached up and grabbed her hair and started pulling her hair. Susan Atkins says she had to fight for her life, at least as far as she was concerned. And then they fell against a chair that was next to the couch. He was fighting, she was kicking him. And she says again in court, "I was all of a sudden fighting for my life." You were fighting for your life. Okay. You infiltrated these people's home and you are fighting for your life. But all right. Then Susan proceeded to stab him 5 or 6 times in the leg. She said it was all in self-defense. And then while this was going on, Abigail was getting loose and fighting with Pat. Except I remember seeing the man I had stabbed trying to go outside. He was yelling. He was yelling for his life. I was hanging on to him, I think, and I yelled, "Tex, help me do something." Then, in the excitement, Tex must have shot him in the back as he was running out, then followed him and hit him over the head with the butt of a gun. It broke the gun handle and the gun wouldn't work anymore, so he began stabbing the man. While he was stabbing, the man was screaming. I am still surprised no one heard anything. The man was pretty much half dead on the porch. That's where all the blood was, I imagine, before he got to the lawn. And then she says casually, "Well, Sharon was starting to get loose from the rope, and the Folger girl already had broken loose and was fighting with Pat. I was just standing there watching. There wasn't much I could do because I couldn't find my knife. I couldn't find it when we left, so I figured that I had lost it in the house, which threw a paranoia into me as we left. But anyway, I can't believe this is how she says it. But anyway, I went over and got Sharon and put her in a headlock. She didn't fight me. I just held her. At times, it seemed so easy. When she began begging me to let her go so she could have her baby, that's when I realized she was pregnant. A flash in the midst of all of that, Pat was calling for me to help her because Abigail was bigger than her and she had long hair, which Abigail was pulling. So I called to Tex to do something. Tex came back in the house and reached up to stab Folger, and she looked at him and said, "You've got me. I give up." But he stabbed her anyway, and she fell to the floor. I think he stabbed her in the stomach because I saw her grab down there. Then Tex went back outside because the other man was on the lawn still running, calling for help, and Tex proceeded to continue killing him. I still must have had the headlock on Sharon when Tex came back and he told me it looked like she wanted to sit down. So I took her over and I sat her down on the couch. She said, "All I want to do is have my baby." I knew I had to say something to her before she got hysterical. And while I was talking to her, I knew everything I was saying to myself. I wasn't talking to her, but myself. I'm not 100% sure I'm interjecting that I believe this is true, and you'll hear why in a second. She said, "Woman, I have no mercy for you." But she said that was her talking to herself, not to Sharon. I just stayed there with Sharon. She was so quiet, and Tex came back in and said, "Kill her. Just like that, he said, kill her. Then, like an echo, Pat said, kill her. She said she reached to grab a hold of Sharon's arms, but didn't want to kill her, and held onto her arms and said, Tex, I can't kill her. I've got her arms. You do it. Pat couldn't kill her either. So Tex stabbed her in the heart again and again. There's also accounts that say that Susan stabbed her through the stomach. But really, who knows and who wants to know at this point? She then said she threw another towel over Sharon's head, and she thinks it could have fallen over Jay Sebring's head too. And she didn't look, she just threw it. And they were curled up on the couch, and their heads were probably close together. Then Tex yelled, get out. They were in there for maybe 25 minutes. Then they were running outside, but we couldn't yell too loud because of being heard by the neighbors. So then when I came out, I said, Tex, do you have my knife? He said, no. I asked Pat, do you have my knife? She said, no. And the paranoia got big, and I tried to shush it by saying to myself, Linda must have my knife. I think I gave it to her. Then Tex ordered me, Sadie, go back and write something on the door. I didn't want to go back into that house. I didn't want to go back, but something made me. I got the towel that I had tied the man's hands with, and I went over to Sharon Tate. And I reached down and turned my head away from her. Then I touched her chest with a towel to get some blood, and I proceeded to go to the door. And the only thing I remember being instructed to write on the door by Tex was pig. So I proceeded to take my hand and write pig with the towel, and I threw the towel back in the house, ran outside. I was the last one to leave the house. When they arrived back at the ranch, Charlie was dancing naked with one of the followers and was confused as to how they were back so quickly. Tex told him that it all went good. They didn't get a lot of money, but helter-skelter had happened. Charlie was disappointed, though. Sharon had pleaded for her life and begged for her mom. She had said, I don't care if you kill me, but please don't kill my baby. Take me with you, and I'll do whatever you want. Just please let me have my baby. Susan Atkins was so spaced out, though, later she said, I didn't relate to Sharon at all. She looked like a department store mannequin and sounded like an IBM machine. When Susan Atkins was finally jailed on unrelated charges, she was housed with a woman named Virginia Graham, who broke the case wide open. Susan Atkins admitted to Virginia what she had done, bragging about it, saying that she had tasted Sharon's blood, and it was warm and sticky. And when she left, she was tired, but elated and at peace with herself. Tex told Charlie he'd only got $70, but it sure was helter-skelter. Patricia complained of her hand hurting after bending a knife blade, stabbing Abigail Folger. Charlie was mad that this murder ended up so messy that he said that they were going to go out again the next night, and he was going to show them how it was done. This was the LaBianca murders. Lino and Rosemary LaBianca had just returned from a vacation on August 9, 1969. Lino, a successful but modest in comparison to the crew that Tate and Polanski ran around with, was a grocery store owner, and Rosemary had a successful high-end women's clothing line. The couple bought a home in Los Feliz that was previously owned by Walt Disney but sold it in 1968. That same year, Lino bought the Waverly Drive home that he'd grown up in from his mother and settled in with Rosemary and her son. In the summer of 1969, a number of odd occurrences frightened the LaBiancas. The couple noticed that when they returned home from being away, items from their home were missing and their dogs were outside the house when they had been left inside. It was later learned that Manson and his family members had creepy crawled several houses in the area while residents were away. They knew of the LaBianca home only because they had attended a party there in the neighborhood and figured that the LaBianca home was as good as a house as any to continue carrying out Helter Skelter. Terrifyingly, the LaBiancas actually bought a newspaper that Lena was reading with the front page all about the Tate murders right when they got back into town from their vacation. How would anyone to have known that they would be next? In court, it was testified that Rosemary was particularly scared after reading about the Tate murders. Sadly, Rosemary's son and older sister were the ones to discover them. August 10, 1969, Rosemary's 15-year-old son, Frank, became concerned when neither his mother or stepfather answered the door. After contacting his older sister and her boyfriend, the three, upon arriving to the home, became further worried by the fact that Lino's boat was parked on the street instead of the driveway. They felt this to be out of Lino's character, and they entered the house. Inside the kitchen, they saw the words Helter Skelter, misspelled, written in what appeared to be blood on the front of the refrigerator. In the living room, they found Lino bound and gagged and stabbed to death. Rosemary was found also stabbed to death in the master bedroom. Tex and Charlie had entered the house first when they found Lino asleep on the couch and woke him up, asked him for any cash they had in the house. Charlie then roused Rosemary from her bedroom and brought her into the living room. Manson then took Rosemary's wallet and went back to the car, sending Patricia and Leslie Van Houten into the house. Manson told Tex to make sure everybody does something. And so they did. Manson then drove off, and the murders were carried out by Tex, Patricia, and Leslie. He told Linda to take the cash out of Rosemary's wallet, and he drove to a mixed-race area of town and told her to dump the wallet where a black person would find it, and use the credit cards so it could be further pinned on a black person and further ignite a race war that never actually happened. Most of what Charles Manson's plans never actually panned out the way he intended. Maybe it's because plans on acid should never be recommended or never carried out in the first place. Because what the Manson family did to innocent victims is likely one of the scariest and heart-wrenching cases I've ever covered. I purposely decided not to go into the details of the LaBianca murders, and I don't want to go into the final murder just to end on how they were caught. Briefly, I'll say that they did kill a ranch hand on Spahn's Ranch, an aspiring actor, but more full-time ranch hand, whom Charlie had been paranoid that this man caused the raid of the family on the ranch, Donald Shorty Shea. Rest in peace. But the events after the murders that lead to their arrest go like this. After the murders, Manson moved the family to Death Valley, where they lived at a place called Barker Ranch, and where they were told to look for, and or dig a hole, looking for a bottomless pit where they would hide out during the race war. They were arrested at their Barker Ranch hideout in Death Valley a few months after the Tate LaBianca murders on unrelated charges of destruction to government property, a U.S. Park Service road grader, and vehicle theft charges. While in county jail, Susan Atkins bragged to fellow inmates about her role in the murders. The inmate then notified authorities. Arrest warrants for the main culprits who participated in the murders were issued, eventually resulting in their capture. And to end this, at trial, Charles Manson leapt at the judge at one point with a pencil clutched in his hand, saying, "Don't let me get the jump on your boys." Manson began speaking to the judge. He started softly, mumbling, But then his volume rose steadily and he became more understandable. And he said, "Are you going to use this courtroom to kill me?" The judge told him to be quiet. "The minute you find me guilty, you know what I'm going to do to you, don't you?" Manson said. "What are you going to do?" the judge said. After a long pause, Manson said, "You know." The judge ordered the defendant, who seemed to be cringing back in his chair, to stop talking. Manson said, "You ordered me to be quiet? While you kill me in your courtroom, I'm a human. I'm going to fight for my life one way or another." Then the judge tries to get him removed. And then, Manson says, "You think I'm kidding?" He went to the top of the defense table like a cat. Standing on the back edge, he leapt about halfway toward the judge. 10 feet away, pencil clutched in his right hand, he landed head first and was eventually taken out. It was a horrifying scene. And that is the end of the story of the Manson family that I am very grateful to be done with. And thank you guys so much for being on this journey with me. And thank you for listening. And I love you. And until next week, bye.
True Crime Podcast fans, it's Patrick and Jillian from True Crime Obsessed.
Each week on TCO, we recap a true crime documentary everyone's talking about, and we do it with heart, sass, and just the right amount of humor.
So if you like the kind of podcast where two good friends chat about a case in a thoughtful way that centers the victims, you really gotta check us out.
Yeah, we cover the well-known cases that you hear about in the news and the underreported cases that desperately need more attention.
For almost 9 years, we've been one of the most popular true crime podcasts out there.
We have over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, and our brand new YouTube channel has over 50,000 subscribers watching our full-length video episodes too.
So find and subscribe True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.